Before I introduce our show tonight, I want to put out a plug for something, and you'll understand why I'm tying the two together and why I waited till today to do it. The Institute for Public Affairs, of which I'm president, is hosting a conference on Wednesday at the Delta Centreville Hotel called Questions of Values, Ways of Response to the Islamist Challenge. It's going to bring together, for the first time anywhere in the world, four of the most authentic voices for freedom and courage that you can find. Bridget Gabriel, the author of Because They Hate, will be coming up from Washington. Wafa Sultan, Syrian-born American psychologist, will be coming from Los Angeles. She's the woman you've seen debating the Islamist clerics in Al Jazeera. Nani Darwish, president of Arabs for Israel. And the former Miss World Canada, Nazanin Afsanjam, who's put aside so much personal ambition to spend her time, devote her calling, her talents, to the case of Nazanin Fatahi, an 18-year-old girl sentenced to death in Iran because she had the audacity to stab the man who was raping her. But of course, under their law, if there weren't four male witnesses, she's considered culpable. The rape never happened, and she's been sentenced to death for shaming her family. We call the conference A Question of Values because we're not going to look at military strategy or political strategy. We're talking about values. What are we as a people, Quebecers, Canadians, ready to do to stand up for the freedoms that we supposedly cherish so much? We've given up so much in the past few years to government. They control our privacy. They share information on us. We've become a people who are fey and feckless and willing to adopt any smug orthodoxy or stupid excuse from government simply to be let alone and get a little bit more in a check. And things like freedom go by the wayside. We live in a society of fear. We're going to examine that on Wednesday. We're going to examine why in Quebec, when a rally is held for peace for Lebanon and Palestine, Israel is excluded in the middle of the war. We're going to examine why in Quebec we have a lake of Hezbollah flags, and we're the only place in the Western world where that kind of a demonstration was led by leaders of civil society, heads of labor, Denis Coderre from the Liberal Party, who affixed the party's name to the manifesto, Andrea Boisclair of the PQ, photographed smiling in front of a Jewish prayer shawl stained in red to symbolize blood. We're going to ask what kind of a society we are. Where do we draw the line? Jack Layton wants to talk to the Taliban. My question to Mr. Layton is, what do you want to talk to them about, Jack? Whether they want to shoot you as a socialist or behead you as a trade unionist? When are we going to say enough and start to live free? And that's what these brave women are going to teach us on Wednesday. Do we question our values, or do we really fight for our values? So anybody who's interested in attending this conference, you can call our offices at 514-875-4884 or email us at info@iapm.ca. Now, this conference has been in the planning stages for weeks, many weeks. The reason I bring it up tonight, and tonight is when I wanted to talk about it, is because tonight is a special evening. It's a special anniversary. 50 years ago today, October 23rd, another nation that had a question of values took to the streets and said, we want to be free. The Hungarian Revolution of 1956 was arguably the most populist uprising that has been seen in the past 100 years. Literally, people with pitchforks took to the streets. Within 10 days, at one point, it looked as if they could win and overthrow Soviet tyranny. It's quite a point and counterpoint to where we are today, where people have given up the importance of their individual consequence. Great Hungarian poet, around whose statue the Hungarian rebels rallied, wrote in the 19th century, stand up, your country calls, the time for now or never fails. Are we to live as slaves or free? Choose one. This to be our destiny. By God we swear. We swear never again any chains to bear. And we're going to be examining this for the full hour, what the Hungarian Revolution meant then, what lessons we can learn from it today. And we'll be back with our first guest right after this. Every society needs a public philosopher, and I'm not sure Canada could have a better one than our first guest, George Jonas. George, you were there in 1956.
I was 50 years younger.
Well, wait a minute. Wait, if we're counting years, I was born middle-aged, so that makes me twice as 30 years older than you. I started the show with the first verse from Sandor Petoffi's national poem. You remember it? Stand up, your country calls?
Indeed, tol pramadya.
The time for now or never fails. Are we to live as slaves or free? Choose one, this is our destiny. And we've often talked in this show, and for those of you unfamiliar with George's work, and I can't imagine there is anybody, he's a regular columnist for the National Post. Go to his website as well. Beethoven's Mask is his latest book. The breadth of the Hungarian uprising was something very surprising then, and I think still is, and in terms of the numbers of people that came out with nothing, with pitchforks. We know the romantic side that the university students started it, but what sparked it? Was it the Polish, the 50,000-person Polish demonstration against the Russians a few weeks earlier?
Well, the interesting thing is that Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, who was the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, said that if a few writers had been shot in time, the Hungarian Revolution could have been avoided.
But a progressive policy.
Progressive policy.
But, he kept in character after, later on beating his shoe on the podium of the General Assembly.
He did. But the interesting thing was that the writers very often referred to Khrushchev's own speech to the 20th Party Congress detailing Stalin's crimes.
Which was monumental, and for those of our listeners who don't know the history, in March of 1956, it was a momentous year. All kinds of things were going on, but one of the highlights of that year, March 1956, Nikita Khrushchev, 20th Party Congress, gave a, quote, secret speech that was disseminated everywhere, denouncing Stalin, and for the first time, validating a lot of the things that the people had been thinking were going on in Stalinist Russia.
That's exactly right. And that was, to a large extent, that inspired the atmosphere in which then a number of people in Poland and eventually a number of people in Hungary started questioning the regime and eventually started questioning the entire idea of whether socialism can be reformed to the point where people can coexist with it.
Now, the Polish demonstrations were in June of that year. The university students in Hungary started to form their Petoffi circles in about October of that year. But the Poles never want, the Poles under Gomulka, they didn't want to say no to communism. They just wanted to say no to Moscow's control. It seemed that Russia at the time was willing to at least look at that as long as it stayed communist. But Hungarian uprising was, we don't want your system.
Well, in the very beginning, the Hungarian uprising was very much like the Polish movement. It was a reform movement. It was only when people who were in control in Hungary perhaps mistakenly, perhaps it might not have made much difference. That's very difficult to tell now. But instead of yielding on certain points the way Gomulka did in Poland, decided to take a hard line. And it was not a time to take a hard line. The hard line backfired, and it resulted in people who were simply protesting becoming revolutionaries.
A lot of people in this country, of course, always take the position that, we can't change anything. And what we say, and you elect somebody, and they sit there like a nail that's lost its head in a piece of wood, you can't pull them out. Except another fascinating aspect of the Hungarian uprising, and it's a lesson that shouldn't be lost on any free people today, is that the man who was considered, quote, the reformer, Imre Nagy, who replaced Rákosi, who was more Russian-oriented, was a colorless bureaucrat. And it was literally the people that gave him the courage to actually turn his sentiments. Because for the first week or so, Nagy didn't know where he was going.
He was concerned even before the Nagy was a communist, but he was a decent human being, and he was equally concerned that communism might fail as a system, because he believed in communism, and he was worried that if certain adjustments are not made and the system doesn't acquire a human face. The expression came later, communism with a human face.
Yes.
Didn't come until the 60s, but the idea was very much there. And Nagy, in fact, dropped a note to Andropov, who was then the Soviet ambassador in Budapest.
Later to the same Andropov, later to be head of the KGB and Premier Russia.
He became the head of Russia,
yes.
Actually. The same Andropov, Yuri Andropov. And Nagy dropped a note essentially saying, look, reform, because if you don't, there's going to be an explosion.
George, hold the thought. We'll continue with the narrative. We've got to pay some bills, and we'll be right back.
Right.
And today, on the 50th anniversary of the October 23rd uprising, the Hungarian Revolution, we're going to spend the whole hour with it, the lessons we can learn from it, the lessons we need to learn of basic human courage. And our first guest, George Jonas, Canada's preeminent social commentator, societal commentator, an exponent of the public philosophy we need to listen to. George, before the break, you were saying that Imre Nagy, the Hungarian leader at the time, was a communist, but he wanted communism with a human face and sent messages to Moscow that, you know, reform or let us reform or things are going to happen.
That's exactly right. He was quite concerned, and he was equally concerned the system that he believed could be essentially very beneficial for people was mishandled to the point where it wouldn't have a chance. And that was a major concern for Nagy. And, of course, eventually he was hanged by the Soviets,
yes,
for trying to defend the Soviet system.
After being assured of safe passage when the Soviets had put down the revolution. Now, 2 days before Hungary arose, and you'll correct me if I'm being too dramatic, the polls under Gomulka said that, supposedly stood up to Khrushchev and the mobilized Soviet troops in Warsaw, but Gomulka said that he'd stay within the Warsaw Pact. The Soviet Union said that, well, that was enough for them not to invade Poland. And 2 days after that, Hungary rises. Was there a message that was missed between Poland and Hungary, or the Hungarians watching what was happening in Poland?
The Hungarians were very much watching. As a matter of fact, the crowds walking in the streets at the time
started as a show of support for the Poles.
Very much so. Very much so. The slogan was, Poland shows us the example. But the next line, the slogan was, but we'll follow the Hungarian way. The Hungarians are a fairly volatile people.
Well, let's say passionate.
They have a short fuse. And when a very arrogant communist minister by the name of Garo, who was asked to address the crowd that gathered outside the radio building in Budapest, made an arrogant, hardline, and under the circumstances, very stupid speech, the crowd reacted in a way an incensed crowd in a situation of this kind often reacts. And since many units of the ordinary police were sympathetic to the crowd, they acquired weapons. And that's how the uprising essentially started late on the 23rd of October. I was working for Radio Budapest and started literally outside my office.
Now, the Russians, of course, are very sensitive to symbolism, and two things happened, both on the 23rd and later on that week, I believe it was October 26th. During the first day, a statue of Stalin was torn down and a Hungarian flag was put around his boots. That was a physical manifestation to the Soviets, and it wasn't just that Hungary didn't want to be communist. They didn't want any part of Russia at all. And later that week, I believe it was October 26th, you had Britain and France and Israel commencing the Suez Campaign. Was it a feeling by Russia at the time or by Khrushchev that, well, if he didn't respond militarily, because at first there wasn't a military response, but do you think he had a feeling that if he didn't respond militarily, Russia would be perceived as weak? Or were they going to respond come hell or high water?
It seems to me that they were perhaps of two minds for a day or two. But the decision to respond was probably taken fairly early. The Russians came, the revolution started on the 23rd, and the Russians came back in force on November the 4th. So there was a period of approximately 12 days.
Where literally, there were Russian tanks in the streets, but Hungarians were taking them apart with knives and pitchforks and axes and screwdrivers.
Well, mainly Molotov cocktails, actually.
And that.
Bottles of ordinary bottles filled with gasoline, which in a confined space, a tank is not a very effective weapon in a very confined space in a narrow street. It can't maneuver well, and if you get close enough to it, it can't use its firepower, and a broken bottle of gasoline sets it on fire.
George Jonas, could you stay with us for another break? I want to get to the American reaction. How much opportunities were missed? What the price of, dare we call it, appeasement was in those days? Montreal, we'll be right back. We're looking at the Hungarian Revolution lessons for today. Talking with George Jonas, we're devoting the hour to the lessons and the legacy of the Hungarian Revolution, which started 50 years ago today. George, we got to the point where Imre Nagy takes over. It's the end of October now, the first week. The Russians still haven't invaded and forced, though their tanks are in the streets. Then Britain and France bombed Egypt by air after Nasser's attempted nationalization of the Suez Canal. Imre Nagy, the Prime Minister, November the 1st, pleads for Western help. 2 days later, Paul Molitor, who is the Hungarian defense minister, goes for a meeting with Soviet Army generals about withdrawing their troops. They arrest him, and 2 years later, he's dead. The Soviets, several days later, invade in force, and within a week, the revolution is put down. Why didn't the West react? Was it that they were too interested in their economic interests in Egypt, in getting back the Suez Canal, or was it simply fear of the Russians, or they just didn't care?
Well, it was a very complex situation. Many Hungarians would not have been happy with the idea of making Hungary a battlefield between the Western powers and the Soviet Union, and have the Third World War break out in Budapest. It was not a simple situation. Military action to assist Hungary would have been a very complicated and complex matter. Perhaps more could have been done diplomatically, and a harder stance could have been taken. But there was a kind of concern that the spheres of interest were split in such a fashion that the Soviets could say, look, we're not going to interfere particularly in what you're doing in Egypt. If you let us clean house in our own sphere of interest. And this kind of realpolitik prevailed.
And yet, 9 days into the fighting, Alan Dulles, CIA director, called it a miracle what was happening in Hungary. The very same man who had refused even to talk to Nasser 2 years earlier was calling Hungary a miracle and hoping secretly for the success of the British and French in putting down Nasser.
In a very curious way, I suppose Hungary was in fact a triumph, even though at the time it seemed a total disaster. It was a crack in what appeared
to
be in the wall,
in the solid iron curtain,
in a monolith that appeared to be impenetrable. In fact, it demonstrated that reforming socialism, communism, really was impossible. It demonstrated that the people were unhappy under it, and it demonstrated that if people rebel against a seemingly monolithic and impenetrable system, they can achieve its downfall.
You, on a personal note, you said it literally broke out in front of state radio where you worked. Where were you during those days, and how soon after did you decide to leave?
Well, on the night when the fighting broke out, I was at home. And I frankly expected it to be over because I had a heavy date the next day, and I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, we had our priorities right even then.
Yes, sir. At the time when you're 21, first things first. But since the revolution wasn't over and my date didn't show, I decided to join the revolution as a second choice. After Soviets returned in force on November the 4th, I concentrated only on making sure that I can get away. And finally, on the 23rd of October, of November, I did.
George Jonas, many thanks for your time, for your reflections, and for your wisdom.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, George. That was part of the history from somebody who was there. Now let's go back to some of the lessons for today. John O'Sullivan, Senior Fellow of the Hudson Institute, Editor-at-Large of National Review, and a repository of a great deal of reason and sanity in our public discourse. Welcome. John?
Be here.
How are you? John O'Sullivan's recent article, Sorry, Not Our Revolution. And this is what I was referring to with George Jonas about American reaction. But John, I've got to quote how you start this article. There aren't any good, brave causes left, railed Jimmy Porter in John Osborne's play Look Back in Anger on its first night in August 1956. Now, any man, any political commentator that can quote Look Back in Anger, one of my favorite plays, hats off to you. But there were good, brave causes left, weren't there?
Well, there were. I mean, the Hungarian Revolution occurred almost to the day, 2 months after the opening night of Look Back in Anger. The interesting thing is, of course, that the Jimmy Porters of the left in England, and Jimmy Porter is a figure on the left, were not particularly enthusiastic about it. I mean, they were embarrassed by it because it demonstrated this was a revolution of ordinary people.
Against socialism, yeah, God socialism. Forbid, that's terrible. John, I'm getting wild signals from Master Control. Bear with us, we've got to pay some bills in a capitalist fashion. We'll be right back to you.
Fine.
Thanks. And tonight we're looking at the lessons and legacies of the Hungarian Revolution, which started 50 years ago today in the streets of Budapest. Massive popular uprising. We guests for the first half hour was George Jonas, who was there giving some of the history. And now we're pleased to be speaking with John O'Sullivan, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. John, before the break, we were saying how the left couldn't bring itself to stand up for this crush. This crushing destruction of a liberal revolution, because that would mean that all their myths about socialism and communism were wrong. It was the God that failed, as Arthur Koestler wrote, but they couldn't admit it, so they ended up supporting Nasser's dictatorship and opposing the Brits and the French and the Israelis who were fighting it.
Yes, I think there were really three reactions from the left. First of all, there was the right-wing Labour, Social Democratic left, and they condemned it unequivocally, and they weren't really implicated in it, and in a sense it kept the Social Democrats honest and committed to committed to democracy for the next for another 10 or 15 years. Then there was the communists. They were, of course, embarrassed tremendously by it and tried to deny that it had actually happened. They tried to suggest that it was all a fascist, attempted fascist coup. And then there were what became known as the New Left. They were the people who actually, many resigned from the Communist Party because of it, but didn't want to give up their illusions of democratic socialism either, and who consequently, for the next, they founded New Left Review in England, a very influential magazine worldwide with the left, and over the next 10 or 15 years, they gradually developed an argument that democratic socialism was still possible, but it had to be done outside the bureaucratic control of the Soviet Union. And that, they believed that right until 1989, and I think at that point, the whole edifice of belief collapsed.
That was the intellectual remnant of the time, but the realpolitik on the ground. You had Alan Dulles, 9 days in the revolution, the CIA director, saying this was a miracle what was happening in Hungary. Was there a real fear of a world war breaking out on Hungarian soil if America had acted in support of Hungary? Would the Soviet Union really have the capacity at that time to meet the Americans?
The answer to your question is that's what people believed at the time. They were very nervous of it. They didn't quite know what would happen if, let us say, American forces had gone in, or Western NATO forces had gone in to assist the Hungarians, or threatened to do so. Had there been a clash with the Red Army, no one could predict where that might end. And because both sides had nuclear weapons, everybody assumed that the world war was a nuclear war was a possibility. I think, in retrospect, if there's been a firmer stand taken by the West, the Russians may well have retreated. But that, one can't be certain about that. Certainly, they did not have the power which we attributed to them at the time. But frankly, statesmen don't want to take unquantifiable risks, and that's probably a good thing.
You write that part of the legacy of 56 was, of course, the Prague Spring of 1968. But is your title of your piece resonates with my mind, not our revolution. Sorry. Is that a mindset that we've got today where populations in countries, and I mentioned at the top of the hour that my institute is running a conference on Wednesday on questions of values and ways of response to the Islamist challenge, that unless countries are directly threatened, nobody can see beyond the tip of their nose in terms of defending freedom? Has that become too costly, too scary a proposition?
Well, of course, that will always be an attitude of many people in politics. It's a perfectly understandable one. You know, charity begins at home. We look after ourselves. We expect other people to look after themselves. It was the emotion that lay behind appeasement in the 30s. It was the emotion that lay behind the decision not to intervene in the Hungarian uprising. And it's behind now the feeling that we don't want to get involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. Sometimes that emotion is perfectly reasonable, by the way. Sometimes there are problems in other countries which we don't know how to solve, and we should be we really should not get involved. And you know, one can make a case, one has to examine these things case by case. But in the 1930s, and I would say, frankly, in the 40s and the 50s too, it was fairly clear that we faced, the West faced a threat from the Soviet Union, which had taken over the countries of Eastern Europe, and we really did not, until very late in the day, give them the kind of assistance to resist that takeover that we might have done. And we didn't really begin to do so until the Reagan administration and the Thatcher administration and others began to help the Poles resist the imposition of martial law in 1981 and 2.
The behavior of Dulles and the effect of Alan Dulles, the CIA, and John Foster Dulles, his brother, the Secretary of State, during the Eisenhower years, would it be wrong to say that they made certain errors in judgment that we're still paying for today? And by that I mean the failure to bring Nasser into the Western circle, the failure to talk to Castro in 59, the failure to support freedom fighters in Hungary in 56, even the role played in the downfall of Mossadegh in Iran. Was this a myopic view of the world that these men shared, and are we still living with these consequences some 50 years later?
I think that the West had decided in the early 50s that it was going to contain the Soviet Union, but it was not going to try to evict the Soviets from those countries which they'd occupied by force after the Second World War. And Hungary was the symbol of that decision. But and it was probably overall, I mean, in many respects, it was probably the right decision, although more could have been done to assist some of the peoples oppressed by the Soviets. However, the fact was that in addition to, in a sense, establishing spheres of influence in 1956, the Hungarian Revolution did something else as well. It demonstrated that the Soviet control on their side of the Iron Curtain was actually more fragile than it had looked. And this was confirmed again and again. It was confirmed in advance by the East German, East Berlin Workers' Rising in 1953. It was confirmed by the Polish riots of 1970, when 24 workers were shot by police.
Right.
It was confirmed by the 1968 Prague Spring. And it was confirmed again by the Pope's visits to Poland in 1979, which led, of course, to the recognition of solidarity. And then, of course, the situation got so much out of control that on Soviet instructions, the Polish government cracked down with the martial law. So all of these things demonstrated that the Soviet grip on these countries was actually more fragile than it looked. It had to be continually reinforced. And at the same time, the Soviets were losing faith in their own system. There was cynicism was spreading, and the time would arrive, and did arrive, when they no longer, so to speak, had the moral courage to use the force that they had done in 1956.
John O'Sullivan, please stay with us. I want one last question, a look ahead. We're just going to take a short break. And we've devoted the hour to an examination of the lessons and legacies of the Hungarian uprising, the Hungarian Revolution that began 50 years ago today, October 23rd, 1956. We're very pleased to continue our discussion now with John O'Sullivan, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, Editor-at-Large of National Review. John, I promise I'd only keep you for one more question, but it's a critical question. What's the lesson for people today, people who seem to be afraid, a West that seems to be afraid of a new ism that's threatening us, when here were people with nothing but pitchforks stood up in the streets against tanks? What's the message and metaphor for us today?
Well, when we're dealing with repressive regimes, the message is that they are more fragile than they look, and it is possible to undermine them by giving support to the revolutionaries. Now, if you're dealing with people who are themselves jihadist revolutionaries, they are a more formidable problem, although they don't have state power, because they are driven by a messianic belief, and one has to carefully build methods of resistance to them. That's a more difficult task. But fundamentally, if we had given to the peoples of Eastern Europe the kind of support we gave to the Poles after the crackdown in martial law, we might have brought communism to an end rather earlier than we did. But there is one other thing, too, to say. There are riots in Hungary tonight. And one of the problems is that in 1989, when these countries became free, there was unfinished business. The communists managed to retain a good deal of political control. They became rich through privatizing industry under their own control, and they returned to politics. And it's very unwelcome to many people. It gives them an uneasy moral feeling when they see the celebrations of the 50th anniversary being led by someone who was the head of the communist youth movement, the present prime minister, and whose wife is the daughter of one of the men who helped to suppress the revolution. So there's an uneasy feeling in Hungary and throughout the Eastern Bloc, I think, that there has never really been a reckoning, that people...
A closure to it.
And it would probably be a good thing if the present prime minister were to resign, if only to bring to an end the terrible riots that have disfigured today. And there have been demonstrations now for the past month, every day in Hungary. And until while he remains there, I don't think those demonstrations will end.
John O'Sullivan, many thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thousands died. 26,000 were put on trial. 13,000 were imprisoned. 300 executed. But the Hungarian Revolution leaves one lasting imprint for today. For all those who would say that there is something to negotiate, for all those who would be involved in the slow undoing of our basic liberties. Let's not forget those brave souls in the streets of Budapest, the brave souls that followed in the streets of Prague, and let's not forget the words of Winston Churchill, that an appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile, hoping he'll eat him last. But eaten he surely will be. It comes down, dear listeners, to a question of values. And on that note, let me remind you again, anyone who wants to register for the conference, and registration is compulsory, admission is free. Question of Values with Bridget Gabriel, Wafa Sultan, Nazina Nafshinjan, and Nani Darwish. Institute for Public Affairs Conference, Wednesday at 1:30 at the Delta Centreville. Please call 514-875-4884 or email info@iapm.ca. Good night, and we'll be back with you tomorrow with our speakers from the conference, and we'll be talking more about freedom and courage and values. Good night for now. Thanks to Nick Mays and Master Control.